Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is John Carreyrou, a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at The Wall Street Journal. And we're talking about his latest book, Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. John, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
This story is an amazing piece of reporting. I cannot recommend this book strongly enough. But the story, as you report it, it was just jaw dropping. I mean, there were so many people involved that could have stopped this along the way, but they didn't. Did you find that in the story? Like, it was just amazing that it went on for so long.
Right. I mean, what you described was really a pattern that unfolded again and again over 12 years.
That's a long time.
Right. No, there were people, I mean, there were ex-employees who tried to get her to stop commercializing and testing on patients a device as early as late 2006, early 2007. They were doing a pilot study with Pfizer that involved terminal cancer patients. Jeez. And Elizabeth Holmes had convinced Pfizer to use the Theranos technology on these patients. Now, granted, the blood tests from the Theranos device weren't going to be, the blood test results weren't going to be used to inform the treatment of the patients, but still the patients were unnecessarily subjected to these blood draws for a device that completely did not work. And there were some early employees who thought that that was unconscionable and tried to get her to pause that pilot study, and she wouldn't. So, yeah, I would say it's absolutely accurate that there were red flags, and it took place for 12 years. There was a consultant that we can talk about that Walgreens hired.
Yep.
That came a few years later. He also raised alarm bells.
And people within the company, within Theranos, that would raise questions, for the most part, were then terminated.
Right. Yep. That was a pattern, too, is you either were with the plan, with the Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani plan. Sonny was her boyfriend, who was the number two of the company.
Okay, we'll talk about him later, because that's another whole story.
Right. Either you did what they said. I mean, they really wanted to hear yes. They wanted people to have a can-do attitude, even if the goals were unrealistic. And employees who emitted doubts or concerns or pointed out flaws or problems were either marginalized or, at worst, fired. And usually the litigation threat was always hanging in the air.
Oh, yeah.
And, the companies outside.
Including against you.
Oh, yeah, that came later when I when I started digging into the company. There were threats, but the litigation threats were always in the air at Theranos. Employees were very aware that Elizabeth Holmes had sued some early employees that she claimed had tried to steal proprietary information. They were also aware that she had sued a childhood neighbor named Richard Fuse for supposedly stealing Theranos patent information. And they were very aware that the outside counsel of the company was David Boies, the country's arguably most famous and feared litigator, and that if they said anything internally to the board or externally to the media or to a regulator, their fear was that Theranos would be coming after them hard and David Boies would be leading the charge.
It also seemed that people wanted to believe their story no matter what they heard.
Right. No, there's a lot of that, I think.
I mean, she sort of seemed like the archetypical figure that you want to believe that story. You know, she's young, she's attractive, she's a CEO of a brand new company that is got cutting edge stuff. I mean, and when contrary information was brought up to different other companies by people who worked there, they would go, no. I think she's going to eventually come up with this.
Right. And so I think there were two things at play. One is that the technology that she claimed to have developed was potentially game changing, being able to do the full range of lab tests off just a tiny drop of blood from the finger.
Time travel would be game changing too, but the difference is it's an extraordinary leap to be able to have that, and so you would think that people would ask more questions.
Right, but a lot of people don't know about the science of blood testing, and they don't know about the challenges with tiny samples. And actually, you know, time travel on the face of it seems intellectually a lot more challenging and potentially impossible than maybe running a lot of tests from a drop of blood. And so she capitalized on this lack of sophistication,
and
on the heartwarming message that if her technology was feasible, then people would get their blood tested more often because it would be more user friendly, and therefore diseases would be discovered earlier.
I want to pause for a moment and sort of pay attention to you putting this book together, because this is an outstanding piece of research and investigative journalism. How long did you work on this book?
Well, I mean, from the moment that I began pursuing a tip about Theranos to the moment the book was published, it was 3.5 years.
And you must have interviewed an amazing number of people to be able to piece together this whole story, because in the book, you don't even come into it until about 3/4 of the way through the book.
That's right. I mean, that was a very conscious decision I made. I wanted the book to contain a lot of fresh information, vis-a-vis what I had published in the journal. And I wanted to explain the whole story and give readers a very clear idea of how things had gotten to that point. And I wanted to make the exposure of the scandal the culmination of the narrative and build up suspense to get to that point. And I also didn't want to make the book entirely about me, so I chose to tell the book in the third person for the first 3/4 of the narrative,
wow,
and then pivoted to the first person for the last quarter.
Let's have a background sketch of Theranos founder and CEO Elizabeth Holmes. Talk to me a few things about her as before she became the Theranos head. It seemed like she always just wanted to get rich. That was her goal as a kid.
Yeah, there's an anecdote in the chapter one of the book. She's about 10 or 11, and there's a family gathering at which she's asked the question that every boy and girl is asked at some point or other, which is, what do you want to do when you grow up? And she answers, I want to be a billionaire. And the relative says, well, don't you want to be president? And she says, no, the president will marry me because I'll have $1 billion. So, and she, you know, I got obviously this account from a family member who witnessed the scene, and the family member says that she was dead serious, it wasn't, you know, an idle the idle response of a child that age. It was someone who was really already driven in that way. I mean, I will say that she also had this notion that she wanted to do good for mankind. Her father had been a public servant for most of his career and worked for the State Department and USAID and had been to war-torn countries to provide disaster relief, and there are pictures of him around the house. And so there's also this notion that she was raised with that she should do good. And I think biotechnology was the gateway to both to becoming very rich and to doing good, because if she could, change the face of medicine and make it so that people would have to say goodbye to loved ones less often, as she liked to say, while getting rich, then that was the best of both worlds.
She also emulated Steve Jobs.
Oh, right. Yeah, Steve Jobs was absolutely her hero. And
it's funny reading your book and then seeing pictures of her in the black turtleneck. It is amazing.
Yeah, no, she took it to the extent that she started wearing the same clothes that he did, the black turtleneck. She codenamed, early in the history of Theranos, when the device was more just a prototype than really anything close to a functioning device, she would refer to it as the iPod of healthcare. And then in later years, she codenamed the last iteration of the device, the 4S, because they started working on it in 2011 at the same time as the iPhone 4S came out. And she also hired the same advertising agency that had worked on some iconic Apple campaigns, Chiat Day, in Los Angeles. And she set up the creative meetings with them on Wednesdays because she learned that that was the day of the week that Steve Jobs had met with Lee Clow, the former Chiat Day creative brain who had come up with some of the great Apple advertisements. And so she felt that Theranos needed to have its creative meetings on the same day.
Now let's talk about the product. The product was, and there, and eventually it becomes, I think, the mini lab. The idea is that you take a single drop of blood, which is amazing, and you're going to be able to run the full gamut of blood tests on the single drop of blood. What else was there about this?
Pricked from the finger, which is also an important part of the vision, and she portrayed herself as needle phobic, which I think was true. She had inherited from her mother a phobia of needles. Her mother, when she was growing up, would faint at the mere sight of a syringe, and so I think Elizabeth inherited that from her, and so that was part of the attraction of the Theranos technology. Would just need to prick the finger, get a drop or two of blood, and then within a short amount of time be able to run all the tests known to man off that tiny sample and get results that were more accurate even than traditional technology. This would have been a game changer in medicine.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, thousands of researchers in medicine, in academia and industry have been trying to crack this nut for the better part of 20 years, ever since the advent of microfluidics. And they just haven't been able to. The main reason is that capillary blood, for one, is not as pure and not as reliable as blood drawn from a vein in the arm, because capillary blood is polluted by tissues and cells. And then the other issue is that there are about six different big classes of blood tests, and the problem is that once you've done one or two or three tests from one class of blood tests, you need completely different laboratory techniques and instruments to do tests from other big classes of blood tests, and by then you've used up your sample. So no one up to this point had solved these riddles, and she, of course, claimed that she had.
And by the way, that's one of the great things about this book is you were able to break this down so everybody can understand the science behind this. As you succinctly put it in the book, she seemed to be unable to distinguish between a prototype and a finished product, and that's where the problems start. She's marketing something that hasn't been perfected, even close to perfected yet.
Right, and that it hasn't even gone to a regulator and been looked at by a regulator and reviewed and approved. Most medical devices that reach consumers and that consumers use have been reviewed by the Food and Drug Administration. And she was trying to circumvent the FDA, and she was also trying to circumvent the other big health regulator in the space, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the agency that regulates clinical laboratories. And she was trying to go to market with essentially an untested prototype. And as one of the many employees who helped me reconstruct Theranos' history told me, it was like as if Boeing delivered an airplane that it had not tested to an airline and told it to just put passengers on it and fly it. And that's actually probably not kind to Boeing, because when Boeing planes come off the assembly line, they're in pretty good shape and they're mostly good to go, but they do flight tests, of course. This notion, this difference between the prototype and the finished product was something that she didn't seem to understand, and it's something that people in medicine and in medical equipment know is a huge part of the process. You usually go through three or four rounds of prototyping before you get the finished product, and then even then you run it through a battery of tests and you get it approved by regulators.
This is where the story gets complicated, and we're not going to go into it because people need to read the book to get the full flavor. But that, you know, she would have different ways of sort of fudging the results, or if she was demonstrating it, she said that, and the, obviously the results did not come out good to this captive audience, she would blame it on the Wi-Fi or something like that. There was always something wrong, and yet it's people got involved and invested money. People like Walgreens, the military was looking at this. There were very famous people that got involved in this. General Mattis, Henry Kissinger, George Shultz. All these people sort of got sucked into this vortex.
Absolutely. And I think the key link here is Walgreens. Walgreens hired a consultant in 2010 when Theranos approached it and made its claims. And Walgreens hired an expert named Kevin Hunter, and he started kicking the tires, and he flew out to Palo Alto to meet with Elizabeth, and he was there with several Walgreens executives, and he immediately started smelling a rat and finding that things were odd. You know, some simple requests that he had weren't being met. And he tried to raise the alarm, and Walgreens executives wouldn't listen to him because they had this paranoia that if they asked too many hard questions of Elizabeth Holmes, then she would turn around and do a deal with Walgreens' arch rival, CVS.
That's right.
And so there's this this factor known as the fear of missing out,
right,
that drove Walgreens to ignore its own lab consultant. And then, of course, when Theranos went live with the finger stick tests in Walgreens stores in Northern California and in Arizona, in 2013 and 14, everyone else, the likes of Kissinger and Mattis and George Shultz, who were on the board of directors, and new prospective investors who came in and started pouring in more money, thought that, of course, not only must this product be real, but there's proof that it's real because Walgreens has gone live with it in its stores, and surely Walgreens wouldn't be exposing its consumers to an untested and unproven product. You know, Walgreens is a 100-year-old, well-reputed company. It would never take this sort of risk. And so people just assumed that Walgreens had done its homework, and of course it hadn't.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is John Carreyrou, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at The Wall Street Journal. And we're talking about his latest book. It's quite a read. Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. I got to talk about Sonny because, okay, Elizabeth is one kind of a character. Sonny comes out as being like something out of Hollywood. I can't explain it. What a wild character within the context of Theranos.
Right. So Sonny Balwani, his real name is his real first name is Ramesh. Sonny is a nickname. Ramesh Sonny Balwani was Elizabeth Holmes' boyfriend, and he was 19 years older than she was, and they first met when she was a teenager, right before she started her undergrad studies at Stanford. They met in China. They were both doing Stanford's summer Mandarin program. And then they stayed in touch, and after she dropped out 18 months later in late 2003, they reconnected, and in the first half dozen years of the company, he was sort of her behind-the-scenes advisor, the older man who'd made money in Silicon Valley and who would teach her how to do business in Silicon Valley. And they also became romantically involved, and as early as 2005 started living together in a condo in Palo Alto that Sonny bought. And then eventually Sonny joined the company. In late 2009, Theranos was on the verge of bankruptcy. Elizabeth had run through the $47 million of funding she had raised in her first three rounds of funding. And Sonny came in and personally guaranteed with his own wealth a bank loan that kept the company afloat. And at that point, with skin in the game, he came in, started working for Theranos, became the number two executive, the chief operating officer, and president. The company then was already not a normal place to work. Elizabeth had always been very secretive and paranoid, and there was tons of turnover. But all of that really goes into overdrive once Sonny joins the company.
Oh, and what an incredible sinister figure he becomes within the company. I mean,
he becomes the enforcer of this culture of fear, and is constantly firing people to the point that it gives rise to a new expression, which is to disappear someone.
That's right.
Sonny has disappeared so-and-so. And he is incredibly arrogant. Even though he has zero experience in medicine or lab science, he tells people constantly that he can do their jobs better than they can. All he needs to do is read a book about their specialty, and 2 days later, he's going to be able to do their job better than they can. And it's this mentality of the software developer on steroids, which is that let's just quickly program, ship the product, we'll worry about the bugs later. And of course, you can't do that in medicine.
No. What you do really well in this book, too, is to give a sense of what it was like to work at the company. I end up feeling tremendously bad for the scientists, the serious people who were there. Inevitably, they got dismissed or fired and let go.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, what I learned in reporting the book is that most of the people who worked at Theranos were smart, people, well-educated, full of integrity, and wanted to do the right thing. And where things went badly wrong at this company was with the leadership, the two people at the top who had unrealistic demands, who didn't want to hear no, who thought that if you just browbeat people and make them work long hours and long work weeks, that things would just fall into place. And the pattern became that people either got fired for raising concerns or would leave of their own volition, and they would leave quietly because, of course, they were afraid of being sued.
They were threatened with if they left. They were threatened with confidentiality.
Yeah, absolutely. Employees had to sign non-disclosure agreements when they were hired, and then there was a whole new round of documents that Theranos made them sign on their way out. And during the exit interview, the HR person would you know, make very clear to them that they had to stay quiet and that they had to abide by these non-disclosure agreements.
In the meantime, she's on the cover of Forbes magazine. She's doing TED Talks. Everybody's buying into this. When do you come onto the story? What tips you off that something's going on and you start your investigation?
Yeah, so she came onto my radar when I read a New Yorker magazine profile of her in December of 2014. She had rocketed to fame about a year prior in Silicon Valley, but I only noticed her then when I read this profile. And there were a couple things that struck me as odd in that story. One was this notion that a college dropout who had spent a year and a half in college had dropped out and revolutionized lab testing. You know, it was sort of following in the footsteps of Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates and all these other college dropouts who had gone on to be, you know, basically computer coders who had founded great companies. And of course, you can do that with coding. You can teach yourself how to code with a manual and spending long hours at a computer. But I knew from having covered healthcare that you can't do that in medicine. You need formal training. You need to go to med school. You often need to get a PhD, and then you need to add value with years and sometimes decades of research. So that struck me as odd. But to be fair, I probably would not have done anything with my hunch if I had not gotten a tip about 3 weeks later. A practicing pathologist in the Midwest who moonlighted as the writer of this obscure blog called Pathology Blog, which he spelled B-L-A-W-G, had noticed the same New Yorker story, and knowing a thing or two about blood testing, had been immediately dubious of the claims that Theranos made in that story, and had written a skeptical item on his blog. And when he did that, he was immediately contacted by a little band of Theranos skeptics, one of whom was Richard Fuse. Right. And Richard Fuse was a childhood neighbor of Elizabeth Holmes, who had been involved in patent litigation with her and who had essentially been steamrolled by Theranos in patent litigation and had become convinced during that litigation that Theranos was a scam. And so he contacted the pathology blogger to tell him he was on the right track. And he, at that point, had more than just his own intuition telling him that he had just made contact with an important employee who had just left the company. And that employee was the former laboratory director. And so when this information was relayed to me, and I heard that there was a primary source of information that I could get to, you know, my ears pricked up, and I sought to get in touch with the former lab director, and eventually did, and that's how my investigation started.
And immediately the lawyers started flying, and the Wall Street Journal obviously backs you up. But there comes a point, it was really fascinating when you talked about when enough information was getting out in the public that all of a sudden it becomes obvious what the story is, and the lawyering stops. And I found that really fascinating, that moment when all of a sudden you're no longer confronted by the Theranos lawyer teams.
Right. I mean, so for months before publication of the first story, we were getting, you know, regular letters threatening us with litigation from the general counsel of Theranos, a woman named Heather King, who had been a partner at Boies Schiller Flexner, David Boies' law firm. And of course, that law firm and David Boies himself were working as well for Theranos. And David Boies came to our office twice to try to prevent publication of the story. And then after the story was published, we kept receiving retraction demands like clockwork after every story from Heather King, listing all the basically the things we'd written in the stories and saying we had to retract them or we would be sued. And then after a few months of this, finally regulators have done several inspections, and it comes out that you know, their findings from these inspections largely corroborate my reporting. And I report this in January, I think it's mid-January of 2016. And at that point, the letters from the lawyers and the retraction demands stop entirely.
This is an amazing story. We're completely out of time. We can't possibly do this justice within the short period of time of the show, but I really strongly recommend this book. My guest tonight has been John Carreyrou, a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And we're talking about his latest book, Bad Blood: Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. John, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks very much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.